good morning. Pennsylvania is the battleground state with the most electoral votes for a candidate to win or lose. But results from the Keystone State may take a while. We'll show you why on this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. There is a legal battle over a Louisiana law requiring public schools to display the Ten Commandments. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. The ACLU and others are suing. They argue it violates the First Amendment and Supreme Court precedent. In Lebanon, a rooftop nightclub that once hosted the capital's Glitterati is now a shelter. It's opened its doors to the displaced fleeing for safety from Israeli strikes. It's Tuesday, October 22nd. On this day in 1964, writer Jean-Paul Sartre wins and refuses to accept the Nobel Prize for Literature. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Election Day is in 2 weeks. Former President Donald Trump is focusing on swing states. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports, in addition to his rallies, Trump has set up several events targeted toward specific demographic groups that he needs to win.
Trump had 3 North Carolina events Monday, including a press conference focusing on the recovery from Hurricane Helene. At that event, he repeated lies about how the Biden administration is spending FEMA money. Tuesday, Trump is scheduled to speak at a roundtable for Latino leaders at his golf club in Doral, Florida. Some polls show Trump having made gains with Latinos compared to past elections. He will then come back to North Carolina for a Tuesday evening rally in Greensboro. Thus far, he also has events scheduled for Georgia and Nevada this week, 2 more states where polls show he and Harris are neck and neck. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, Charlotte.
Vice President Harris campaigned in 3 states yesterday, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. She was joined on the way by Republican and former Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who has endorsed Harris. Cheney harshly criticized Donald Trump, calling him unfit for office, and says Harris is the leader the country needs.
You know that she's going to lead this country with a sincere heart. You know that she is going to always be thinking about what is best for this nation.
Harris will sit for an interview tonight with NBC News. An organization that helps people obtain affordable mortgages is calling on its millions of members to vote in the November election as a condition of membership. NPR's Frank Langford explains.
It's a novel approach to encouraging voting. The Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, known as NACA, has told its 3.7 million members that they have to vote or risk losing membership and the financial benefits that come with it. CEO Bruce Marks says NACA will check to see if members, most of whom are working class and people of color, vote, though it won't know which way they voted. He also says there are more than 870,000 NACA members in the 7 swing states. Legal experts say they aren't sure NACA's new requirement is legal, as it could make access to a financial benefit, a low-cost mortgage, conditioned on voting. But Mark says NACA is just setting membership requirements like any other organization. Frank Langford, NPR News, Washington.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken has arrived in Israel on his latest visit to the Middle East. The Biden administration says it continues to back a ceasefire for Gaza and in Lebanon against Hezbollah. Blinken is expected to meet Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Meanwhile, Israel continues to bomb targets in northern Gaza. The UN agency that helps Palestinians but is opposed by Israel says it cannot get enough aid into the region to help people. It says many are still buried in rubble from an Israeli weekend attack on a refugee camp that killed nearly 90 people. Israel says it's targeting Hamas. This is NPR. A new report finds that wildlife populations have declined about 73% on average over the last half century. NPR's Julia Simon reports from Cali. World leaders are gathered in Colombia to discuss how to protect the planet's living creatures.
At the opening of this United Nations conference, Afro-Caribbean women perform a song. Oh, yeah, mama. Indigenous communities are often at the forefront of protecting ecosystems like rainforests, mangroves, and rivers that harbor much of the world's biodiversity. Colombia says this conference will feature their voices more prominently. Susana Mohamed, Colombia's environment minister, is leading the event. To make peace with nature will require shifting values, she says. She notes that helping biodiversity requires addressing the burning of fossil fuels. Julia Simon, NPR News,
Cali, Colombia.
Leaders from nations with developing economies are meeting in Russia this week for the BRICS Summit. BRICS is an acronym for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. They'll look at stronger economic ties, but host Russian President Vladimir Putin is expected to show himself as a strong international leader. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is not at the BRICS summit. A Brazilian official says Lula is recovering from a minor brain hemorrhage he sustained during a fall at home last weekend. The official says Lula is recovering well. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Linda Mood Bell Learning Centers, online instruction available anytime, anywhere for students to catch up or get ahead in reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodBell.com/NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
Halloween. Carved pumpkins, scary costumes, and piles of candy dumped into bags at the magic words, trick or treat. But in 1991, that sugar-coated holiday got a snow coating. Peter Boulay is a climatologist with the DNR.
So everybody from meteorology students to the National Weather Service knew a big storm was coming. What we really didn't realize is how much snow was going to fall.
The snow began in earnest during afternoon rush hour. It clung to costumes and turned orange and black decorations a uniform white. Some kids never went out that night, which meant more candy for everybody else. But the trek was a slog through ever-deepening snow. From October 31st to November 2nd, the Halloween blizzard dumped 36.2 inches of snow on Duluth and 28.4 inches in the Twin Cities, which is still a Twin Cities record amount for a single continuous snowfall.
Well, it's one of those big weather events. You kind of remember where you were at that time.
What's this? There's white things in the air. What's this? I can't believe my eyes. I must be dreaming.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadil in Washington, D.C. Coming up, we'll tell you about a tech company that wants to scan the eyes of every human being.
We begin, though, with our election reporting series, We the Voters. Stories from Pennsylvania, the swing state with the most electoral votes. Here's our co-host, Michelle Martin.
It is unlikely that we will know who won Pennsylvania on election night. That's because, due to a law created 4 years ago, election officials are not allowed to open mail-in ballots until the morning of November 5th. That's the sound of some of the machines that will count those ballots once they are opened, overseen by election office employees who are required also by law to work around the clock until they are finished. Here's Lehigh County Executive Phil Armstrong.
We're figuring anywhere from 70 to 80,000 mail-in ballots in Lehigh County. You can't open up those ballots that day and hand take them all out and have the results done an hour or two after the polls close, which people are used to. And the longer it takes, the more people think something's wrong.
We asked Pennsylvania Secretary of the Commonwealth, Al Schmidt, to join us to tell us more about the process because he oversees all of it, including the vote count throughout the state, and he's with us now. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
So, you know, you've been explaining this for months now. You know, you've been going all over the state explaining how the process works. Do you think that you've put these conspiracy theories about dead people allegedly voting or finding mystery ballots to rest?
Conspiracy theories really require no basis in fact whatsoever, it seems, when they get generated and when people begin to believe them. But I think it's incumbent on all of us to make sure that, one, the public is educated about what's involved with counting their votes, and two, to have appropriate expectations for when we'll all know who won and who lost and by how much.
Even back in November of 2020, you were a city commissioner in Philadelphia. You said that lies about how the counting was going were ridiculous. Did you ever have any doubts yourself before you started doing this job? No.
No, not for a second. I'm a Republican and I've been involved in Republican politics a while back. Had run elections for, I think, 8 years prior to that. And elections have changed so much where we now have a voter-verified paper ballot record of every vote that's cast and two audits to make sure those results are accurate. But it's no wonder people have questions, and it's our responsibility to answer those questions.
Why do they have questions?
People are used to thinking, oh, we're going to know the results 10 or 11 at night. And you might. But those hardworking civil servants and professionals at the county and state level, their work doesn't stop once a network or station calls and says who won and who lost.
You know, Pennsylvania is no different than any other big state that has densely populated urban areas. It has more sparsely populated, you know, suburban or rural areas where the more densely populated areas would report later because they just have more votes to count. So why do you think it is that Pennsylvania became the target for so many conspiracy theories and just frankly so much hatred in 2020?
Well, I think for one, Pennsylvania is probably the biggest swing state. But what we saw in 2020, we saw that window of time between the polls being closed at 8 p.m. on election night and the race being called as a period of vulnerability where people were seeking to undermine confidence in the results.
You just mentioned that you are a lifelong Republican. I think you were the first person that the Democratic Governor Josh Shapiro appointed to his cabinet. Why did you agree to take this job?
Well, I believe in our system of government. I believe in our democratic republic. And I believe if there's something that I can do to help serve, then it really is not something that I had any hesitation to do whatsoever.
Even with all the threats, it's my understanding that, you know, even people's families have been threatened. Some election officials have to send their families away because of the abuse.
I'm certainly going into all this with eyes wide open, but believe in Governor Shapiro and his incredible commitment to democracy and protecting it from efforts to undermine the outcome or the perception of the outcome.
After the 2000 election, which I think many people will remember, it took months to resolve. It was finally resolved by the Supreme Court. Former President Jimmy Carter, Democrat, and former Secretary of State Jim Baker, a Republican, led a bipartisan commission to try to give people more confidence in the election system. The whole point of it was to say voter fraud is not really a thing. What might put the genie back in this bottle now?
I think it's just really important that people know the truth about elections and they have access to information. And that's why the job that you do is far more important than mine in terms of communicating with people so that they do know what to expect and why the system is done with integrity. 2020 wasn't really close. I mean, Pennsylvania was decided by more than 80,000 votes. And that's why I think these conspiracies have been so far-fetched, because it's not talking about one or two votes. It's got to be something ridiculously enormous, a truckload of ballots or vote switching or whatever paranoid fantasy people seem to indulge in to explain why their candidate lost.
That is Al Schmidt. He is the Secretary of the Commonwealth in Pennsylvania. Mr. Schmidt, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
That's our co-host, Michelle Martin, who, along with Steve Inskeep, will host a sold-out live event at WHYY in Philadelphia tonight. We'll hear some of the highlights tomorrow on Morning Edition.
Louisiana passed a law earlier this year that requires public schools to display the Ten Commandments in every classroom.
The ACLU and several other groups have sued the state to stop the law from taking effect in January because they argue it violates a Supreme Court precedent and the First Amendment. Parties met for the first time yesterday in a federal court in Baton Rouge.
Aubrey Yuhas with member station WWNO has been following this case and joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So who are the plaintiffs in this case and what are their attorneys arguing?
The plaintiffs consist of nine Louisiana families. Some are religious, others aren't. And their lawyers argue that the children of these families and other children in the state will be harmed if the Ten Commandments are posted in classrooms. The attorneys have asked that the law be blocked while the case makes its way through the courts.
And the state, what are they saying?
The state obviously has larger constitutional arguments, but yesterday the focus was on whether this case can even move forward. Attorneys for the state argue plaintiffs don't have a case until the posters go up in January. They say there's no grounds for allegations of harm until then, so they've asked the judge to throw out the suit for that reason.
Okay, so let's take a step back. Let's talk about what this state law that's being contested actually says. What does it say about the Ten Commandments and how they're meant to be displayed in public schools?
It's pretty specific. It says the Ten Commandments need to be displayed in large, easily readable readable font. Hmm. The law also says posters displaying the commandments have to include a context statement, the exact wording of which was included in the law passed by Louisiana's Republican-controlled legislature. It's several paragraphs, but in short says the Ten Commandments, quote, were a prominent part of American public education for almost three centuries, though I should say some historians argue that isn't true.
This is such a closely watched case. A lot of concern around whether it violates this notion of separation of church and state. Why has it captured the nation's attention in this way?
It's because people are concerned that the Supreme Court could overturn that precedent if a case relating to this law makes its way to them, and that in overturning that precedent, they could take down the wall between church and state in part. Critics argue the law clearly violates the First Amendment, which protects freedom of religion. Here's Andrew Perry, an attorney for the plaintiffs with the ACLU of Louisiana.
The premise of the Constitution is that religion is something that is private, and it succeeds best when the government just stays out of that conversation.
The U.S. Supreme Court struck down a similar law to Louisiana's in 1980. In that ruling, the court said requiring schools in Kentucky to post the Ten Commandments, quote, had no secular legislative purpose, was plainly religious and therefore unconstitutional. Now, Louisiana's Attorney General argues the state's law is different and constitutional. She says it passes a history and tradition test and that it's about teaching morals. Opponents aren't buying that, though. They say this case is about getting something that's already been decided back to the Supreme Court, which now has a conservative supermajority.
When is the federal court here expected to make a decision?
The judge says he'll make a decision by November 15th. That'll include, you know, whether he's going to stop the law from taking effect in January. Attorneys say their case isn't the only legal challenge to this law. So even if this case doesn't move forward, it's possible another one will and could eventually make its way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Aubrey Juhas is with member station WWNO in New Orleans. Thank you for your reporting, Aubrey.
You're welcome.
The tech venture WorldCoin says its goal is to scan the irises of everyone on Earth. Now, to do that, they have to convince people to stare into a shiny football-sized device called the Orb. NPR's tech correspondent Derek Kerr went to WorldCoin's first major event.
The scene inside this nondescript building in San Francisco is straight out of the TV show Silicon Valley. A DJ spins techno music, servers pass around detox juice made of golden beets. The Wi-Fi network is called New World. Most everyone here is spreading the gospel of the Orb. I speak to David Khosrowshvili.
You're basically like an evangelist. You're trying to get other people to try and get their irises scanned also.
Yeah, because a lot of people are sometimes, I don't want to scan my eyes. And once you actually have your hands on the hardware and the tech, and once you look into it, I think your confidence level increases, the fear goes away.
The Orb is a creation of WorldCoin. It sees a future where people use their iris scans to prove they are human, or as they say, authenticate personhood. WorldCoin was co-founded by ChatGPT CEO Sam Altman. Here he is speaking to the crowd at the event.
We want to see what happens when we do this at mass scale.
Mass scale is something WorldCoin has pushed for years. It says 7 million people are now on its network from Asia to Africa. In exchange for their iris scans, many of those people got vouchers for cryptocurrency, somewhere between $20 and $50. And that's raised privacy and security concerns for some governments. Countries like Kenya and South Korea have even suspended WorldCoin. But that hasn't dimmed the venture's enthusiasm.
To provide access to every human, we need more orbs. Lots more orbs, probably on the order of 1,000 times more orbs than we have today.
That's Rich Healy speaking at the event. He's an executive at WorldCoin's parent company. He says that anyone can now buy an orb and start scanning their friends and family.
I want all of you guys here today to be our first community operators. Everyone here will get an orb.
The tech venture's final announcement? It's no longer called WorldCoin. Now, it's just World. Dara Kerr, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. At oil and gas drilling sites in New Mexico, people work long hours doing hard, dangerous labor. Marcela Diaz of Somos Un Pueblo Unido, an immigrant-led workers' rights nonprofit, says more than 40% of the workforce is Latino.
Most of our members in this industry, in this region, are not unionized. They don't have pensions. If they're undocumented, they won't have access to their Social Security benefits. And when there are downturns, they don't have access to unemployment.
Diaz says that as the clean energy industry grows, many oil and gas workers are eager to transition to new jobs. But it's hard to get the necessary training when you're working long hours, or if you lack English language skills, or live in a rural area.
We just don't have the kinds of programs that we need in these communities.
So her group is pushing for more accessible workforce training programs and support that would make it easier for workers to participate. For example, a new state program will pay workers, regardless of their immigration status, to participate in workforce training programs in renewable energy and other fields. Diaz says it's an important step towards helping people who have provided essential labor for the state's oil and gas industry move into safer, clean energy jobs. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Focus Features with Conclave, based on the novel. After the Pope's unexpected death, the Catholic Church's most powerful leaders gather to select a new Pope, uncovering a trail of deep secrets. In theaters everywhere this Friday. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. More than a fifth of the country of Lebanon is now displaced. Families, mostly from the south, where Israel says it's targeting the Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah, have fled their homes. And many are now taking refuge anywhere they can find it, including nightclubs. NPR's Arzu Rezvani takes us to one.
If you had visited Sky Bar just a couple of months ago, you'd have found the crown jewel of Beirut's nightlife. Perched on the waterfront, Beirutis and foreigners would drink and dance until dawn. Those days are now long gone. What used to be the dance floor is now home to hundreds of displaced families. The DJ stage is covered in sleeping mats. And those big burly club bouncers, they're now babysitters watching children chase each other in and out of the club while drones buzz overhead. Skybar, one of Beirut's hippest nightclubs, has been transformed into a shelter for displaced families fleeing Israel's bombing. In one corner of the dance floor, I meet 48-year-old Faten Asaf, whose life has turned upside down.
We sleep somehow unpeacefully, feeling afraid, feeling scared. Yani, I think there is no place which is safe now, because people are being killed everywhere, and I can't feel safe anymore.
Faten was a high school English teacher, her husband a plumber. For years, they had lived a quiet life in Dahiya, a densely populated suburb of Beirut, with their two kids. That all changed the day Israel dropped massive bombs on their neighborhood to kill Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah.
The explosion was so huge, yani many explosions one after another, and I dragged my children, like, dragged them so fast. I ran away without my scarf.
They've been living at Sky Bar ever since, eating food and sleeping on mats donated by nonprofit organizations and donors. She's grateful to be alive, but having watched the horrors unfolding in Gaza, she's resigned to what war could bring her.
I'm so tired. We are tired. Now just I don't want to run away anymore. I will stay here. If God wishes, yani, me to die, then it's God's wish.
Hezbollah began firing rockets into Israel the day after Hamas launched its surprise attack on Israel last October, triggering a low-key conflict across the border. A month ago, Israel stepped up its attacks on Hezbollah, killing its leader and then sending ground troops into Lebanon. When I ask Faten who she blames for the war, for her displacement, for her family's uncertain future, she holds back. Whether out of fear or frustration, she steers clear of politics. But across the dance floor, 57-year-old Sabah Farhad has little doubt. Israel and America, she says, her daughter echoing her in the background. Israel has no mercy, does not differentiate between fighter and civilian, between young and old, she tells me. Saba shows me her little patch of the dance floor. A tea kettle boils in one corner. She tells me her family has been twice displaced. First from their village of Hula in the south, where Israel has carried out the most intense bombardments in Lebanon, and from the Beirut suburb they relocated to that Faten also fled from, Dahiya. Like many people in this club, she's certain her home is gone, destroyed by Israeli airstrikes. And like many people in this club, it's not Lebanon's government she sees coming to their aid or defending their lands. It's Hezbollah.
We want to allow the resistance, the fighters, to do whatever they can to fight the Israelis back. We want them to liberate our lands and to allow us to go back to our villages with our heads held high.
There is no going back for Sabah or Faten, not anytime soon. The war is expanding. Israel has ramped up its bombings across Lebanon in recent days. Hezbollah continues to launch drone and rocket strikes into Israel. And more than a million displaced Lebanese people are watching and wondering if they'll ever make it back home. Arzu Rezvani, NPR News, Beirut.
Twenty years ago today, the quota system that guaranteed tobacco prices for U.S. farmers ended. Since then, tobacco farms in Kentucky have all but disappeared. Here's Lily Burress with member station WKMS.
Dale C. grew up on a tobacco farm in rural western Kentucky, where he learned the trade from his dad. But after more than 50 harvests, the 68-year-old decided to pull the plug on the crop.
Made a hard decision this year to not grow tobacco. And it was strictly... well, probably one of the hardest things I've ever done, you know, but it was had to be a financial decision.
C also grows corn and soybeans on his farm outside of Hopkinsville, but he says his farm saw diminishing returns from what was once Kentucky's top cash crop. It's become too expensive with the cost of land, labor, and seeds.
We're fighting a lot of issues out here in the tobacco industry, from weather to prices to you name it.
Generations of farmers have grown the crop, even as health risks of tobacco have been known since the 1960s. Then, in 1998, a settlement between tobacco companies and states over the health care cost of treating smokers raised the cost of cigarettes. It also restricted advertising and marketing of tobacco. Tobacco use has been decreasing in the years since, and C says things are different now.
The day as we knew it growing up is over for the tobacco plant itself.
The biggest decline in tobacco growing came after the quota program stopped in 2004, says Will Snell. He's an agricultural economist at the University of Kentucky.
We weren't competitive on a world basis. Our prices got too high under the program.
Snell says tobacco was no longer the cash crop it had been in Kentucky since the 1930s when most farms grew some tobacco.
It put people through college. It bought a lot of cars and tractors and trucks over the years.
The crop is still being grown on Scott Lowe's farm outside of Murray, where workers are cutting stalks of dark fire tobacco. It's the variety used for snuff, chew, and cigars. Lowe says dark fire tobacco has allowed him to keep the traditional crop around.
Well, it is still the bread and butter for our family and many families throughout this region right here.
He also has cattle and grows soybean and corn on his farm, but considers tobacco the staple crop for his operation.
Not only do I love growing tobacco and am passionate for it and know the impact it's had on our family along with families throughout the county, we wouldn't be doing it if we didn't make some money.
Lowe still sees a future for tobacco even as the crop has been declining for 20 years throughout Kentucky. For NPR News, I'm Lily Burris in Callaway County, Kentucky.
This is NPR News.
For years, Donald Trump has threatened his critics with prosecution or even jail time, and some are warning that a second Trump presidency could make those threats a reality.
He will absolutely make sure his enemies pay for what he perceives to be their crimes.
A closer look at the former president's calls to investigate his rivals on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts at 4 o'clock this afternoon on KAXE. Good morning. It is 5:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for tuning in to the Tuesday morning show. Coming up in just a few minutes, our daily dose of phonology with John Latimer. Coming up at about 6:45, student phonology talkbacks. And at 7:20, John Latimer's latest nature observations on the phonology show. It is our fall membership drive. Come home to KAXE. Where Northern Minnesota wakes up, whether it's talking nature with John Latimer, diving into the arts, or breaking down local politics, your mornings are filled with rich local conversations that you won't find anywhere else. You can show your support for that right now. Donate at kaxc.org. Thank you so much. We do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms today, high 65 to 70, lows tonight 32 to 35, and tomorrow sunny. Cooler, highs in the upper 40s, breezy northwest winds 10 to 20, gusting higher. Looking ahead to Thursday, a chance of showers in the afternoon, mostly cloudy, highs in the mid to upper 50s. Northern Exposure to Lifelong Learning presents a program on life as a Viking woman with Althea Kenny this Wednesday at the Gonvik Community Center. Refreshments served at 9 a.m. The program is at 9:30. The Hibbing Area Chamber of Commerce, the City of Hibbing, and the Hibbing Foundation are teaming up for a Trunk or Treat event this Saturday from noon to 2 at Hibbing City Hall. One free pumpkin per child while supplies last. And Zion Lutheran Church in Grand Rapids has a meatball and lefse dinner this Saturday from 4 to 6:30. Proceeds go toward the maintenance of Camp Hiawatha and for kids to attend camp. Let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. Also this Saturday, it's Flannel Fest at the historic Kalava Hall in Virginia with Sloppy Joe meals available at 5 p.m. and then live folk, bluegrass, and Finnish music from the Lindelow Brothers from 6 to 8. Wear your best flannels. Proceeds benefit the preservation of the hall.
On today's date, October 22nd, 1985, the lilac leaves began to fall. And the leaves fell green. They do so every year. The lilac does not change its leaf color prior to drop. What makes lilacs especially important and interesting in phenology is that they are genetically identical from one location to another. There is but one lilac. And if you plant that lilac in Des Moines, or you plant it in Minneapolis, or you plant it in Grand Rapids, it's going to give you a very concise phenological record because it basically is the same plant. It's not genetically different from all the other lilacs. So it's an important plant to keep track of. And if you have lilacs just now losing their leaves, in the springtime, you may want to make record of their bloom dates.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Insperity, providing HR services and technology from payroll, benefits, and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at Insperity.com/HR Matters. From Solidigm, focused on making solid state storage optimized for performance and efficiency, Solidigm believes a new era in AI requires a new approach to data storage. Storage for AI.com. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Nebraska is one of 10 states where abortion is on the ballot this election. It's the only state where voters will choose between two opposing proposals. One aims to expand abortion rights. The other would enshrine the current 12-week ban in the state's constitution. Here's Nebraska Public Media's Elizabeth Remmert.
Around Omaha and Lincoln, signs compete for your attention. Some show pictures of babies and say it's the fight for their lives. Others prompt you to use your vote to end Nebraska's abortion ban. Ads from the Protect Our Rights campaign, which is backing the initiative to guarantee abortion until fetal viability, tell voters they need two votes from them at the ballot box. One supporting their measure and another vote against enshrining the current abortion limit. That is, right now, Nebraska bans abortions past 12 weeks with exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother.
Nebraskans do believe it's just not something that our government needs to be involved with.
That's Allie Berry, campaign manager with Protect Our Rights, the pro-abortion rights group. One of the group's TV ads features Kimberly Passica, a Lincoln woman who learned late in her first trimester that her baby had a non-viable heartbeat.
I suffered with pain and bleeding for weeks. So please, vote against 434 and for 439.
Speaking about her experience, Passica said she joined the campaign because Nebraska's current law didn't allow her to access medical care while she lost her child.
I had to wait knowing loss was inevitable and death was occurring inside of my own body. I felt like a walking coffin.
On the other side of the issue, groups favoring the current 12-week ban say the viability initiative has overly broad exceptions, lenient medical standards, and not enough room for regulation. Sandy Danick leads Nebraska Right to Life and says the rival measure is turning out new volunteers for her group.
And I found that very encouraging, that people maybe who have never done anything with this issue are calling us.
Danick thinks Nebraska could reverse the trend in other states where voters have usually backed abortion rights. She says the 12-week limit her group supports gives voters another choice.
I think it helps to reveal the difference between the two amendments, and people will go to that more common sense approach.
Officials say that if both proposals win a majority of votes, whichever gets the most votes will win and be written into the state constitution. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Rembert in Omaha, Nebraska.
Thanks to AI technology, there's now a chatbot that can use your voice and sometimes even likeness. And this can be done without your consent. So all of this got me thinking about whether this is morally okay. It's something I asked James Brousseau. He teaches philosophy at Pace University in New York and has written about how to make AI more ethical. As someone whose voice is literally their job, I wanted to know, will chatbots replace radio hosts like me?
I can tell you that they're not going to replace you immediately. And I'm fairly certain of that because, in fact, I am trying to make a chatbot avatar of myself in coordination with a computer science department where I work in Italy. And we cannot make yet a conversational agent that can produce anywhere near the kind of conversation that I can produce. Even though it's true that we can reproduce the way I sound, that part we have more or less under control.
And what are the ethical issues when you think about reproducing people's voices? Because I was listening to that and I was thinking, but at some point, does it make you redundant? If it gets much of a good professor?
Right. I mean, it's only one short step from there to say, well, why have me at all in the first place? And we do need humans interacting with others to see and understand what kinds of new issues are arising and so on. That's where the training data comes from these kinds of avatars. So we will always need philosophers to update the traditional ideas for the contemporary reality. But it's true that inevitably this technology will reduce the number of philosophers that have jobs. That's true.
But are there ethical issues that come with the possible benefits?
So if you think the way we treat a simple tool like a pen, if the pen runs out of ink, well, we just throw it out and we replace it with another. We don't even hesitate. Whereas by contrast, if a human being runs out of food, we don't just throw the human away and replace it with another, right? We have a sense in the way we live that humans are not like things. Mm. And so the idea of dignity is that quality of humanity, that quality of not being replaceable, substitutable by something else, even if it looks the same and acts the same. And we usually argue that these kinds of agents, and if there is a violation, they violate someone's dignity in the case that these chatbots are made of someone without their consent.
So there's now technology out there that allows you to create what are being called death bots, which are using the voices of somebody who's passed away to create, in some cases, even the physical likeness of them. What are your thoughts on using material from someone who has died to create something in their likeness?
I think that there is fundamentally a different human relationship between those we love, members of our family, and those who we do not know. And within sort of the context of dignity that I had just outlined, there is a different kind of relationship that people have with those they love. And part of that is a willing to sacrifice, in some sense, your dignity for each other.
Yeah.
If it were used by a loved one to support themselves, then it may be in some abstract sense a violation of this notion of dignity that we discussed. Mm. But this is the way that families and loved ones coexist together.
Are these chatbots, or will these chatbots, change the way we as humans communicate with each other?
There is a real debate surrounding this subject. And I can give sort of a quick example of that from from another professor. He was asked to write a recommendation for one of his students, and the student wrote to him also with the prompt that he suggested the professor use for ChatGPT to write the recommendation. And if this is the way things develop, then the written part of a recommendation will just be ignored. And the only part that people will pay attention to is the numerical part that is usually in a recommendation.
So it'll be like, oh, a bot wrote this, so we can ignore it.
Right, exactly. And then the result will be that recommendation letters will no longer have a narrative component. They will just be numerical. And so in that sense, in this case at least, it seems as though ChatGPT is not coming up to our level. Rather, it's dragging us down to the level of computer numerical interaction. This is the way we grade each other, through numbers instead of with qualitative words.
That's James Brousseau, who teaches philosophy at Pace University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Your story. These aren't the kind of roots that you trip over when you're walking around in the forest outside. These are the kind of roots that we call fine roots that are sort of narrower than this cord that's connecting my headphones to my computer right now. So just millimeters and thick, but they do all the work of acquiring that water and those nutrients needed to keep those towering trees above us alive.
I'm Heidi Holton. With your help, we can tell the stories of the plants and the trees of northern Minnesota. Support the stories by becoming a member now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. And thanks for your support.
PR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters on Friday, November 1st. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The U.S. and its allies often say Russia's unprovoked full-scale invasion of neighboring Ukraine in 2022 led to its international isolation.
But Russia tells a different story, one that'll be on display as President Vladimir Putin hosts leaders from many of the world's fastest developing economies in Russia this week.
Joining us to talk about it is NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. Welcome.
Hi there.
Hi, Charles. So what is this summit and who's on the guest list?
Well, this is the latest incarnation of what was initially known as the BRICS Group of Developing Nations. That's an acronym for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. They've since added a plus to the list to show their growing roster, which includes new members such as Iran, Egypt, United Arab Emirates as of this year. And the group looks to grow even further with Turkey, Azerbaijan, Malaysia waiting for admission. You know, all told, the Kremlin says 22 world leaders will be attending, including China's Xi Jinping and India's Narendra Modi. The Kremlin is billing this as the biggest foreign policy summit in Russian history, and they're all coming to Kazan. That's the capital of Russia's Republic of Tatarstan, where I should add locals have been told basically to stay home, both out of concerns for security and to control the optics of the event.
I mean, 22 world leaders doesn't sound like isolation. So Russian President Vladimir Putin must be feeling pretty good about that.
You know, that's a safe bet. The fact that these world leaders are all coming at this moment is a PR coup for Russia. The Kremlin would argue it's the latest proof, if it needed any more, that Russia is not at all isolated over its invasion of Ukraine, as the West would claim. Even the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, is in town for this event over the objections of Kyiv, I might add. Meanwhile, BRICS nations represent nearly half the world's population and increasingly a new world order, as Vladimir Putin argued during a speech at a related event last week in Moscow. Let's listen. So here Putin says companies from BRICS countries already dominate key economic industries like energy and agriculture. And in the not too distant future, BRICS nations, he says, will be the drivers of the global economy.
Aside from growing economic might, what else unites these countries?
Well, you know, in the lead up to the summit, Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov was asked something similar. He contrasted BRICS to the G7, the West group of seven leading industrialized economies, but saying that the G7 was a club no one else could ever get an invitation to, whereas BRICS, in Peskov's telling, was a far more democratic institution. You know, but you're right. I mean, essentially, you know, many of these countries share resentments about the way global wealth and economic power is currently distributed. But the thing is, they approach the solution differently, whereas, you know, Russia, China, and Iran perhaps see BRICS through this geopolitical lens, a way to take on the West. Others like India and Brazil aren't interested in that same level of antagonism. They strike a more neutral stance, for example, when it comes to Putin's actions in Ukraine. You know, they basically want to see what BRICS can do for them and to make the world economy more fair and just.
So beyond the symbolism of it all, is there anything concrete expected to come out of the next few days?
Well, there are going to be a lot of bilateral meetings between leaders, so I'm sure you'll see a bunch of deals. Russia and Iran are expected to also sign a strategic partnership agreement that'll be closely watched by the West. But if Putin has his way, this conference will make significant progress in one area in particular, ending the dominance of the U.S. dollar. He wants to see BRICS nations come up with new financial mechanisms that could ultimately sanction-proof economies like Russia's from the West.
That's NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Amy Martinez.
It's Megan Buffington from the KAXE News Desk, where I cover northeastern Minnesota from my home base in Grand Rapids. As a lifelong northern Minnesotan, this job isn't just reporting for me. It's personal. Board Chair Keith Nelson said at a press conference Thursday that he spoke with Governor Tim Walz about the flooding Wednesday evening.
The governor.
Last year, 50 units at Red Pine were vacated with little notice after a building inspection revealed dangerous conditions. Tom Schuett, the company's CEO, told the council Monday.
The two islands are part of the Raleigh-Johnson Natural and Recreational Area. Jim Brandt has watched over the islands, literally, for decades. He and his wife Jackie.
If you're craving local news with a personal touch, join me, Chelsea Perkins, and Larissa Donovan on the Up North Report for in-depth coverage of life in our neck of the woods. And if you've got a story you think deserves attention, don't hesitate to reach out to us at news@kaxe.org.
U.S. scientists are finding an enormous amount of the lithium needed to green up the economy.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, focused on offering smart business buying solutions, leaving time to focus on growth. More at AmazonBusiness.com. And by Bitwarden, with a reminder that investing end-of-year IT budgets into an enterprise password manager can be smart spending for effective workplace security. Bitwarden.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in New York. There may be enough lithium to supply the world's demand for car batteries and much more sitting under southwestern Arkansas. The U.S. Geological Survey announced that finding yesterday. Marketplace's Henry Epp reports.
Lithium deposits under Arkansas could meet projected demand for electric vehicle batteries nine times over, the USGS says. Lithium-ion batteries are in lots of devices, but they're especially important for EVs and hybrids. As more companies rushed into the EV market a few years ago, prices for the metal shot up. They've since dropped as more supplies came online and EV demand growth slowed down. But lithium is expected to be an important commodity for years to come. And right now, the U.S. imports about a quarter of its lithium. The vast reserves under Arkansas could change that. And already, companies like the fossil fuel giant ExxonMobil have set up operations to get at these deposits. That could be a challenge. The lithium under Arkansas is in brines, meaning it's mixed with water. Right now, lithium brines are usually brought to the surface, then put in large pools where the liquid evaporates. But Exxon and others hope to extract the lithium directly from the ground. Whether that can be done cheaply enough for them to turn a profit remains to be seen. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Last year, the Energy Department confirmed a separate vast source of lithium in the geothermal region near California's Salton Sea, southeast of Palm Springs. Checking markets, S&P futures are down 0.5%, but GM stock is up 2.7% in pre-market trading now after it posted much better than expected profits a few moments ago. It's charging a lot for vehicles in the U.S., offsetting weakness in China. Now, if you don't like your salon or barber, you just switch. But you ever try that with a bank? If the fees or service stink, banking is sticky. This morning, federal regulators announced new open banking rules to both make your financial data more secure and portable. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is also hoping these changes will make it easier to try new financial apps or to cut off your data if you cancel. The head of the CFPB has seen these rules as a way to stop established financial firms from what he called weaponizing standards to their own advantage.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by the full-time Plus Flex MBA program at Indiana University's Kelley School of Business, the only two-year MBA that lets you choose where you spend your second year. More at go.iu.edu/kelleyflex. And by Rubrik. When cyber attacks put businesses at risk, Rubrik provides the power to bounce back fast. More at rubrik.com. And by Clear Channel Outdoor, an out-of-home billboard company that offers data-driven advertising solutions for businesses big and small. Billboardsforbusiness.com.
Now to dating apps, with big names like Match and Bumble struggling to keep investors and people looking for connection happy. Some smaller rivals see an opportunity here, including a sapphic-focused dating and community app called Her. My colleague Nancy Marshall-Genzer spoke with Robin Exton, CEO and founder of Her.
Why did you launch Her? And I guess it was, what, about 10 years ago now?
When I very first started, there were so many platforms that you could use, at least web-based platforms, that were designed for straight people. I think at the time there was, you know, like hundreds of straight people. There were probably like 50 that were designed for gay men. And there wasn't a single one that had been designed for queer women. The few things that existed out there at the time were platforms that had been created for gay men, but they had been turned pink and they said, great, this will work fine for lesbians. And it was a terrible experience. It was, you know, bad design, bad user experience. And so in my 27-year-old brain, I was like, I can fix this. How hard can it be?
From what I'm seeing, many people just aren't willing to pay for a subscription to a dating app right now. How are you hoping to continue growing, considering that, especially since some users have complained that Her is a little glitchy and others don't like certain features that are under a paywall?
Yeah, we definitely, you know, we have a premium subscription. Dating apps are often at least 50% of the top 10 largest revenue products in the app store. So it's a business model that works. And across most of those products, fewer than 10% are paying for subscriptions. And that's okay. You can still get a date for free. The people who do want to invest in a premium subscription often have higher intentionality and they want to have the control to be able to get to that outcome faster. I think on Her, like, we're a much smaller team than a lot of the other people in our industry. Her is a team of about 28 people. So there's definitely whatever the kind of women version of David and Goliath would be scenarios playing out. But I think it also goes to show how much people value the experience that we give them in this sapphic space, because it's not perfect. We do have to deal with like bugs and glitches and fixing them as soon as we can and get it out there. But we do it as a team with so much care and so much heart that they stick with us as we continue to kind of improve the service and grow.
A big source of revenue from dating apps traditionally has come from men. How have you been able to navigate the market without catering to straight men?
Yeah, I think, you know, effectively, you know, monetizing LGBTQ plus women, non-binary trans people is relatively uncharted territory and space. And honestly, I think it's partially a privilege. Like, we get to actually study and explore what do our users find valuable and what do they want to pay for. And that's stuff that these larger platforms, they're not even going to bother looking at it because they're going to focus on the people who are building money for them. And they're going to continue to build features and services that cater to cis men because that's who is funding the platforms.
Yeah. But how do you keep your, especially your trans and non-binary users safe?
Yeah.
If you do have transphobia, even within the Her community.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that we take so seriously. We have so many layers of safety, like different machine learning models to different AI tools. We have layers that include human review teams. So any content that is flagged either by our systems or by users inside the app is then reviewed by humans. We have moderators who are inside of the app and inside of the community and looking at both our community space and the content that is reported. And then on a kind of like macro level, we invest a lot on the platform in education, because I think a lot of people assume that if you identify as LGBTQ+, everyone is fully aware of all the different nuances of different identities. And that's completely not the case. There is still so much work that has to be done within the community to educate each other about what these different identities and experiences mean for different users.
Robin Exton, CEO and founder of the sapphic dating app Her, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And in New York, I'm David Brancaccio, and we are from APM, American Public Media.
Good morning. It is a minute before 6 o'clock. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Find more at KAXE.org. It is our fall membership drive. Come home to KAXE. You can make your donation right now at KAXE.org. Click on that donate button. Thank you so much. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for more for Morning Edition and the Tuesday Morning Show with John Latimer and Heidi Holton. We do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms today, high 65 to 70, winds from the southwest 10 to 15, gusting higher. Lows tonight 32 to 35, and for tomorrow, sunny and highs in the upper 40s, breezy northwest winds 10 to 20, gusting higher.